Well, we only read 8 verses from Psalm 37. If you have been following it in your own text, you will see that there were 40 verses in it. It's an extended psalm. It's written as an acrostic poem, with each stanza starting with a successive letter from the Hebrew alphabet. That's very interesting, but I don't suppose it means much to us, because not a lot of us know much Hebrew, certainly not me. So I was looking for a succinct summary of the psalm, and I came across two. One quite simply said, "This is a contrast between the wicked and the righteous." And when you read the psalm, that's what it's all about. It's all about the contrast between the wicked person and the righteous person. Somebody else said, "There is no finer exposition of the third beatitude, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, than this psalm," which, if we had read through to verse 11, you will notice includes the words, "the meek shall inherit the earth." And out of this 40-verse psalm, I have one short verse which accounts for 2% of the words in the psalm. Don't let an accountant anywhere near anything. And this is our text for the morning. It's one of the promises of God. It's one of the promises that we're picking up in this series. And it says quite simply, "Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." Now, we need to start with some understanding of the word delight. The Hebrew root implies, and the modern dictionary confirms, that it is a feeling of great pleasure. That's just what it is. Now, in that definition, I think the word feeling is quite important, because delight involves our emotions. We can and should think deeply and positively and extensively about God, but we sometimes, perhaps quite often, do that and experience very little delight, because we remain in some way remote or unengaged. And so I would hope that out of this morning we might not only think, but that we might engage with what the psalm has to say to us. I'm not a fan of pickled eggs. I don't like the look of them in the murky liquid in the big bottle with greasy finger marks on it. I don't like the texture of them. I don't like the taste of them. And that's an infantile conviction reminiscent of our grandson, who immediately, when presented with any food he hasn't eaten before, says, "I don't like it," because I've never actually tried a pickled egg. I can, however, imagine a situation where that might change. If I hadn't been able to get any food for a fortnight and pickled eggs were the only option, I would probably be delighted to eat it. My delight would have arisen from a new perspective. I would be very, very hungry. I might then find that pickled eggs are a real delicacy, and my delight would be enhanced by my experience. Indeed, so delighted might I become, and my attitude may become so revolutionized, that I might set up a pickled egg appreciation society, so that the more I talked about them, the more delighted I and other people would be. Now, that's a silly story, clearly. But we have picked out of one psalm, in fact, we have picked out of 8 verses of one psalm, one little verse. And in those 8 verses in front of you, There are 10 other equally important instructions, because take delight is an instruction. Let's just remind you of them. The first one is do not fret. That actually appears 3 times. It must be quite important. And literally that means do not get heated up. That's what the word translated fret means. Don't get heated up about wicked people. Don't get heated up about the way the world is. Don't get heated up about the way things annoy you. And then there's trust. Repeat it twice. There's do good. There's dwell. There's enjoy. There's commit. There's be still or be silent. Interesting. There's wait. Refrain. And turn. Now you'll notice that all of these are actually quite powerful words. There's no anemic words in that list. These are words that we can't comfortably duck. When confronted with any of those words, they demand a reaction. But we will not understand delight without putting it in the context of these other words. Together with the rest of the psalm, they tell us something about perspective, they tell us something about reaction, and they tell us something about attitude as far as verse 4 is concerned. So let's look, first of all, at perspective. As I said, the theme of the psalm is the contrast between the wicked and the righteous. And the perspective is the constant message of the psalm, repeated time and time and time and time again as you go through the rest of the verses, is reflected in verse 1. And that is that the apparent success of the wicked is short-lived. You see in verse 1 it's compared to a green plant that just shrivels up and it's dry. And as you read through the psalm, you'll find that not only is the perspective that the way of the wicked is short-lived, but its end comes at a terrible cost. Now, our own inherent God-given sense of justice demands that this be so. When we see something wrong, our cry is for justice. We do sometimes see justice in these things in the course of our lives, but often not. People can steal and lie and damage others and end up revered and honored by our society simply because our society does not have eternal values. But not infrequently, wickedness does not become apparent. Some years ago, the papers and the social media were awash with angry comments about a star escaping justice because he had died before his crimes came to light. But we know, and these verses encourage us to look ahead, to remind ourselves that our lives are set in the context of eternity. And so the values we espouse must be eternal values, which of course include eternal justice. But this perspective is not just a time eternity perspective. It's also a weakness strength perspective, a power weakness perspective. On 17 occasions in this psalm, we are directed to the Lord, before whom all success and power of the wicked cannot stand. And this should give us all a pause for thought. We who claim to know Jesus as ourselves, is this the perspective that we have? And does it show? Do we live with an eternal perspective? Is that where my values lie? And if you're someone here this morning and you're resisting the call of Jesus on your life, where does that leave you? The object of our delight is to be the Lord. Take delight in the Lord. Our reactions to this we explore through the next set of words. Recognizing the perspective will result in various reactions, but some of the words here are helpful. In verse 3, we have the word trust. Now, if you are a believer this morning, if you're a child of God this morning, if you're saved, whatever terminology you choose to use to describe your position, that's where it all started. Either over a period of time or at a clearly identified time, you and I decided that we could and would take God at his word, and so we exercised faith. We trusted him for salvation, for forgiveness, for the power to live. That was the essence of what happened, however it happened. We, in some way, looked at the cross, and although for many of us it was with limited understanding, we saw the step that we needed to take, and we took it. But sadly, sometimes we park that decision as historical, a time at which we ticked a box or achieved an objective in some way. And we forget that if that decision was real, it will have become a way of life. Trust in the Lord. When I'm down or worried or in despair, which happens far, far more frequently than it should, as someone in this audience will testify to, I force myself to remember that if I can trust God for my eternal security, then I certainly can trust him for everything else, however serious or trivial. But then I ask myself, why is this so difficult? And maybe the next word in that list helps. The word commit in verse 6. Again, this is a serious word describing a serious reaction. Perhaps the one illustration of it is an athlete committed to their training. Note in this case, as in the case of the athlete, that we're not asked to commit ourselves, although obviously that is good, but the particular wording used is to commit our way, our life, our life's path, our conduct, our actions, the way we live, to commit them to the Lord. And in practice again, this is a daily call. This is not a one-off thing. This is a way of life. That day by day and week by week, we commit our way to the Lord. And the third one's interesting. Be still. Literally, apparently, it means be silent. How often do we do that, most of us? Stop. Be quiet. Stop talking and allow the Lord to speak to us. Challenging, isn't it? So simple. So challenging. The next set of words I put under the heading, well, better note the promise first of all. The promise is that we take delight in the Lord and He will give us the desires of our heart. But the next set of words I have under the heading of action, I think something has got out of line, but don't worry. The action words are these. The outcome of trust is that we will do good. And that also appears in verse 27 of the Psalm. This action that will come out of our perspective and out of our reactions to that perspective will show itself in doing good. Sometimes we are so concerned to emphasize that our salvation does not result from what we do. That's right. But we do forget and do not engage with the fact that what we do is a testimony to the reality of our salvation. James made that clear. He reminds us that faith without works is dead. Jesus reminded us of that. He instructs us to let our light, our salvation, shine before man so that they may see our good deeds and praise our Father in heaven. That's Matthew 5 and 16 if you need the reference. So one action word is do good. The second action word tells us to dwell, to continue, if you like, in the land. Now the author would have been thinking of the physical land that God had brought his nation into. But Spurgeon's comment maybe is helpful to us here. He said, "You shall not wander in the wilderness of murmuring, but abide in the promised land of contentment and rest." I wonder, does that kind of not describe my life? Do I, perhaps you, spend more time wandering in the wilderness of murmuring than we do abiding in the promised land of contentment and rest? We've all been called to dwell in this world with all its sin, its heartache, and with the different standards, but we're called to dwell, to act, to witness, support, worship, and serve. In fact, we're called to live Jesus. That's our calling, in two words, to live Jesus. But the good news, because and those outside will not understand this, we're told to enjoy all of this. You know, this is good news. This is good news. We're to enjoy two things. We're to enjoy security, and we're to enjoy the sustenance that is ours, safe pasture. And we're not only allowed to enjoy what God in His grace has given us and brought us into, but we're commanded to do it. But don't forget the things we're told not to do. We're to refrain from anger and turn from wrath. If you happen to be in Port Stewart on a Sunday evening, you will notice a strange phenomena. Dozens and dozens of people, not all young, just in case you think they are, driving up and down the promenade in cars every element of which has been washed, cleaned, polished, prepared, enhanced, and tuned to within an inch of its life. I, as a man who regards a car as something that gets you merely from A to B, cannot imagine the time and money and effort that must go into this. But as I walk along the promenade in Port Stewart on a Sunday evening, I have no difficulty in working out what delights these people. The delight in their vehicles is obvious. And usually it's not too hard to identify what we delight, because it's what we choose to spend time on, choose to talk about, what we know most about, what we invest our resources in. And here we're told to take our delight in the Lord. We delight in what we love, be it diamonds, cars, family, houses, holidays, and so on, none of which are necessarily wrong in themselves, but surely if they exceed our delight in the Lord, we have got questions to ask ourselves. But this verse is not just an instruction. It is, as you're reminded by the screen, a promise. Those who delight in the Lord are promised that he will give them the desires of their heart. And I guess we really like the sound of that, don't we? But isn't there a bit of a problem here? Jeremiah pointed out to his audience that the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond curing. Who can understand it? So it seems to me that if God were to give us the desires of our hearts, it would on most occasions be disastrous for us, because our default position will always be to want the wrong thing. If I could put it this way, and to try and sort of get at the issue here, the promise is not transactional, like a vending machine. With a vending machine, we put in the code, we put in the payment, and out comes what we have chosen. Because of our heart problem, our immediate desire is to think this promise means we insert our delight and out comes whatever we want at that particular moment. And clearly that cannot be the way it works. So I would suggest that this promise is not transactional in that sense, but it is transformational. As we spend more time with the Lord, so our delight grows. As our delight grows, we are being changed. As we are being changed, our hearts and its desires are being changed. And so, as the circle goes round and round, God is delighted to grant us our desires, because they are basically his desires. I guess there might be somebody like me here this morning who at this point is saying, I can't really say I delight in the Lord like that. And the response to that I personally found most disturbing, and perhaps you will too, is that it's because we don't know him well enough. Simple as that. Perhaps some people here, of course, don't know him at all. You have never taken that first step of faith. And perhaps, well, not perhaps, certainly this morning would be a good morning to put that right. But even those of us who do know him as Savior, perhaps we haven't really set out to know him better, or even to know him well. And that's where all those action words we mentioned come into play. Don't get heated. Don't be envious. Do trust. Do good. Do dwell. Do commit. Do be still. Derek Kidner, commenting in this psalm, says that our obsession with the wicked, or indeed our obsession with anything else, cannot simply be switched off. Obsessions are like that. You can't just switch them off. But he says they can be ousted by a new focus of attention. In this case, the Lord. on Jesus, for whom our love grows the more we know him. And Kidner gives us a very helpful definition of delight and a challenging example. He says that delight involves a deliberate redirection of our emotions. We take our emotions and we deliberately redirect them elsewhere. And his example, which in a sense, well, let's see what you think of it. His example is Paul and Silas in the Philippian prison singing as well as praying. I can't imagine what their emotions were originally, but I can see how they redirected them. And you know, I went back and I read the story again, and I'd never really noticed, or it hadn't registered with me, that Luke tells us the prisoners were listening to them. And I guess that the release, the conversion of the jailer, and the subsequent encouragement of the believers might all have been close to the desire of Paul and Silas's hearts. I'd like to mention one other relevant little germ later on in the psalm. We've been talking about delighting the Lord, but in verse 23, we find that the Lord can actually delight in us. And not just delight in us, but delight in our ways. And when he does, he makes our step firm. Not a measure of when we think we're doing well, but it's as we stumble, the verse tells us. And his delight is demonstrated in the fact that although we stumble, he will not let us fall, and he will uphold us with his hand. Amazing that in some way our delight in the Lord is reflected in his delight in us. This is a wonderful promise, but what will we do to pursue it? I'm sorry to go back to Port Stewart again. I was brought up in the North Coast, and there's a bit of that still in me, a lot of that still in me. There are many, many beautiful views in the country where we're blessed to live. And I quite often have cause to walk from the herring pond in Port Stewart up over the hill behind the harbour and then down onto the promenade. And on nearly every occasion, I stop and I look out west. I can't really describe what I see, but among the things that I see are Port Stewart Strand, the sand dunes behind it, the estuary of the Ban entering the sea, Castle Rock, Mussenden Temple sitting perched on the edge of the cliff, and beyond all that, the fields and trees of Benevena. Every day is different. The seasons change, the weather changes, the shadows cast by the clouds change, the colour of the sea changes. I seldom fail to be delighted by it. Not because I'm analysing it. Not because I'm trying to identify what colour is what. My only part in this delight has been to take the effort of walking up the hill. The delight follows on from that. So that's really, in a very simple illustration, where I want to leave us this morning, but with a suggestion. How do we walk up the hill to experience that delight? And I'd like to take you back to all those words that we have been looking at. And I would invite you to do this. In the next minute or so, as I finish speaking, look at those words. Pick one of them. I'm making this simple. Pick one of them. And take a few minutes for each of the next 7 days to think about it and how it applies to you and your relationship to the Lord. Note it down. Put it somewhere where it's likely to remind you, on your glasses and car keys, your fridge, your wallet, your book you're reading, pop up in your phone, whatever works for you. Just that one word. And as you dwell on it, however briefly, let it lodge in your mind and ask the Lord to use it to bring you closer to Him. Involve your emotions. React to what God has done for you, or how you feel about Him, or the mystery that surrounds Him, or even the fact that you don't have much reaction at all. There is a time to puzzle out the answers, but never forget that our faith is essentially a relationship to be developed that can touch every element of our being. So I've encouraged myself and you to once again fall in love. To fall in love with Jesus. So take a moment, choose your word, and I'll pray.